Okay. So last week we dealt with chapter 11 of Daniel, up through verse 35. And let me go ahead and move this forward. And as I said before, that really was the time in Daniel chapter 11 of the first 200 years approximately after Daniel passed away. All of that is history. And we spent a lot of time last week. If you were here, we spent a lot of time talking about who the kings were, who the people were, who the daughters who were married off, all the fighting between the king of the north, which was the Seleucid Empire after Alexander the Great, and the king of the south, which is the Ptolemaic Empire. Both of them being subsets of Alexander's kingdom. We talked about all the infighting and what all happened, and all that's history. You can go back in history, and actually, when you read the verses, while it's not doesn't cover all the history, what's covered actually has historical roots, and you can go figure out who the names are and the places and the dates, the times. And that was up through verse 35. In verse 36, we're not that lucky. Because 36 begins to move into a time in the future. And so we don't have history to back it up. All we've got is speculation. And so I'm going to do a lot of speculation today. But again, it's not history. So, it's just my version of it. So coming up, so I'll do another session at Manor Lake on the 21st. And of course, you had Thanksgiving. I did session two. And we got. I got session three at Manor Lake on December 5th, and then the class Christmas party. And hopefully, we'll finish next week, Book of Daniel. So I will start a new lesson and book on the December 10th, and that'll go for 1 week because the following 2 weeks, we're going to do the two Christmas lessons that I'll try to change them a little bit from the last couple of years, but they're basically the same two Christmas lessons we have done in the past because it's important. We've got a number of new people in the class, and then just things have happened maybe that will help us with that. I've got an idea of what I'm going to do. It's a kind of a one lesson follow-up to this lesson, or to the lesson in Daniel. So we'll talk about that as we get a little closer. So I mentioned that chapter 11 and 12 are the fourth vision of Daniel. And the two parts, we did part one, and we're going to do part two today. But part two, we have to understand without history, because part two really speaks of the time we live in today and what's going to happen in the future. Part two is still future for us. It's not past. So there's no history to be able to pull out and relate it to. And of course, that makes it a little difficult for detailed interpretation. But if you believe prophetic word, and I do, then you have to, when you look at this second part, you can get the big picture of what's going to happen. And I think the big picture is important. We should never get so focused on the details that we lose sight of what the big picture is, because the big picture is probably all we'll remember anyway when we leave here and we do something else. All of the details of Daniel won't matter, but the big picture of what it was, how it proclaimed, how it came true, and what it portends for the future is really important for us to understand as we think about prophetic world, what's happening. So I'll finish next week and summarize Daniel. I want to spend a minute. This is not up to date, of course. I'll spend a minute on Israel. I finished this up on Friday, so what happened yesterday is not in the notes. I'll try to speak to that. But there's reason for hope right now in Israel, but there's also some concerns. They re released a number of Israelis. I can't remember, 24, I think. I don't remember. 13. 13 Israelis, 10 people from Thailand, one Filipino were released yesterday. But there's still 200 to go. And yesterday they released another set of people, but they violated one agreement. The agreement was never to separate families. So they sent children home without their parents, claimed they can't find their parents, but the children say they had their parents with them up until a day ago, and then they separated them. So you know there's something going on there, and I don't know what it is. It could be the parents aren't in particularly good shape, and they don't particularly want the world to see that. So they may be treating them. I don't know what they're doing. Or they may be trying to use it as a bargaining chip. I just think it's important. But if you look at these pictures, you can see that aside from one or two of them, which are grandmothers, they're all women, aside from one or two of them, they're children. And when you read in the newspaper that Israel traded hostages for hostages, don't believe that. Israel's people were hostages. The people they traded were prisoners. And there's a big difference. They were people convicted of a crime and convicted of trying to stab or kill people or of doing terrorism. So Israel is giving back terrorists for innocent victims. But there's, you know, in the press, they try to make a parody of it, like they're the same, and they're not the same, and they'll never be the same. And you'll see a lot of Israelis press back on people like the BBC and Reuters and others who try to make comparisons about just hostages or hostages, you know, just trading them back and forth. But it's really different. I will say that there was a whole flurry of activity before the thing took place on Friday. Israel had gone in and destroyed a bunch of tunnels and done a bunch of things to keep Hamas from coming back into them, depending on what happens next. But yesterday, the middle of the day, Hamas announced they were going to delay because Israel had violated the terms of the conditions. Actually, Israel didn't violate them, they violated them. But anyway, they did that, and there was a lot of pressure put on them. So at a little bit before midnight, Eastern, not Eastern time, Israeli time last night, they coughed up another few people, and I'm not sure what the number is, but it's small.
19.
19. So there's 14 Israelis, a couple of the rest of them are all foreign, I believe. But again, if you look at the pictures, they're children and young women, I mean, like 19 or 20 and under. So they're being very selective in who they release, probably people that are in good health and were in good health. The good news is they took them all to the hospital and they've checked them all out, and the ones they have are actually in pretty good health. Now, I don't know what their mental state is, because you could see in the pictures, if you watched any of it, these little kids were running to their parents when they saw them, you know, when they got them back into Israel. So a lot of joy in Israel right now, but there's still a lot of heartbreak because there's still 200 prisoners, maybe 190 now, that have not been released. Among them are the Americans. The Americans, about 10 Americans, have not been released. And I suspect there's going to be a little bit of pressure put on for that, you know, in the next day or so. So I don't know where this is going to go. It's a 4-day process, and they're supposed to release 50 hostages, I think, in 4 days. So they're not there yet. So they're going to dribble and drabble it out as fast, as long as they can, and try to, you know, keep the fighting from starting. Israel is fighting, however, in the north. They're not fighting in Gaza, but they're still fighting Hezbollah in Syria and Lebanon. So that's not part of this agreement, and so they're still doing that, doing it with a little more vigor, I would say. And I think that's probably encouraging. Is that we'll see this week what happens when Israel debriefs the prisoners and understands where they were kept, who all they saw, what the conditions of them were. If any of them were killed, they'll know that. So Israel will have a lot more information. Now, what they share, I don't know. They may not share a lot of that. But anyway, we'll get more information. I think that's encouraging. I would just say continue to pray for the situation. It is still very volatile, still very difficult to fathom, and you know, in the world, there's still a lot of people who don't believe what happened over there. They believe it's all, you know, Israel's made it all up. Although Israel has documented it now and it's on videos, I would never watch them myself, but they're showing them around the world to people who are skeptics. And from my understanding, they're very, very graphic, and it's not something you want to, not something you want to see. But anyway, that's kind of what it is. U.S. forces are still under attack over there. They've increased the attacks on U.S. forces in Syria and Lebanon and Iraq. The U.S. is beginning to respond, but they're not responding with great strength right now. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. Several more missiles and drones have been fired at Israel from Sudan or Yemen. I'm sorry, Yemen. And they've all been intercepted. So it's kind of a stalemate right now. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm sure there's going to be a pause until as many of these hostages come out as they can. But Israel told Hamas yesterday, if the hostages were not in their hands by midnight, they were starting the bombing again. And so they coughed them up. And I think Israel passed the first test of them in terms of trying to drag it out. But we'll see where it goes. I don't know. I'm skeptical. I'm nervous about it. But God is in control. And I know this is in God's ultimate plan, as terrible as it may be. I was reading an article this morning about 1947 and all of the Arab states and how many Jews were in all the Arab states and what that number is today. And you look at all these places like Libya and Ethiopia and Sudan and Egypt, and the number of Jews was fairly high in 1947, but they're down to, in many cases, zero, and 10 or 15 in other cases. So the Jews have made their way out of all of these Arab countries that don't want them, and and come back to Israel, because all of those people came to Israel, the ones that were still alive. And so that's kind of interesting. It's strange the way God's plans work out. We may not see them, but the whole plan to get Israel back in its country, I think, was started by the Holocaust. And so many Israelis then, or the Jews, more properly were called, were so distraught with what happened that they packed up and they moved to Israel, where they were wanted. And of course, that was part of God's plan. It's unfortunate that had to happen the way it did, but it is interesting how tragedy sometimes can be a catalyst for God's will. Not that he intends it that way, but it's a catalyst for people to do what God had in mind for them to do. Any questions about Israel so far? I think that's all I have on Israel. Yeah. So.
This gives Hamas a time to rearm, but everything is so surrounded, I don't see how they can rearm.
Well, I don't know how they can either, unless they have a couple of tunnels we're not familiar with. You know, they found other tunnels now. But I think Israel is wise to all that, so I don't think they're going to get much time to rearm, personally. Israel has got the sea blocked. They've got all around Israel blocked. They're in the northern part of Gaza. And they've got pretty much control of the southern part, even though they haven't destroyed it. So I think they're watching what's happening. And of course, if they find a tunnel, it'll be taken care of. The greater risk, I think, for Hamas is Israel has done what the U.S. stopped doing a few years ago, at least publicly. They've basically declared that they're going to pursue to assassinate all the Hamas leaders that are hiding overseas. So they're going to kill them all in Qatar, and wherever they're hiding, they're going to seek them out. And I know that's not popular these days, but I think for Israel, they're not really too concerned at this point. So that's all I have on Israel for right now, but I'll talk. Yeah, Joe.
One of the demands that Hamas had yesterday was that humanitarian aid be sent to northern Israel.
Right.
I read this morning Hamas has set up a
the northern Gaza. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as long as the world doesn't call them out, they're going to do whatever they do. You know, they're fake scenes with fake blood and fake babies. You know, they do that to get the world's attention, and they take the pictures far enough away that you can't really tell whether they're dolls or whether they're real children, or they've got video of them after the scene is over. They all stand up and take their clothes off. You know, they put back on their regular clothes, so they're all actors. But it's a pretty terrible situation. I think the PR battle, though, has turned, and it's not exclusively for Palestinians or the Gazans now, Hamas. It's people are also beginning to see the farce that is there. So That's good news, I guess, and we'll see how it plays out. I don't really know yet.
We just need to pay for the rest of it because my son said that they wanted about 25 pairs of tax in the major thing.
Yeah, I think people are predicting that all of these terrorists don't live in Gaza. They live all over, and due to our border insecurity, many of them have come in their sleeper cells. I mean, you just look at the people all over that are praising Hamas and having demonstrations. They're everywhere. And, you know, cities have got to be on control. I don't know that they really determined this Canadian thing, whether that was terrorism or not. I think they think it was, but I don't know. That thing that blew up on the Rainbow Bridge. Why would you be driving from America into Canada with a car loaded with explosives? That's my question. Yeah, but, you know, they'll figure it out. I mean, they will figure it out. I heard they found an Iranian passport, you know, 50 feet away, probably get blown out of the car. So I don't know. But I think you're right. People are on high alert everywhere, thankfully so. So let me go back now and kind of get back into Daniel. And I want to go back to chapter 2 of Daniel, because we can never lose sight of Daniel's purpose and the purposes of the vision. In Daniel chapter 2, we saw Daniel give an interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a statue. And if you remember, I'm not going to go into all of that. You can go back and listen to those lessons if you want to hear all of that again. The statue had a head of gold, which was Babylon. It had a chest and arms of silver, which was the Medo-Persian Empire, belly and thighs of bronze, which was the Grecian Empire under Alexander the Great, and his four follow-ons that came from that. Then came legs of iron, which is the Roman Empire. And of course, the legs are both the eastern and western part of the Roman Empire. And then we got to the bottom of the statue, where feet were made of iron and clay. And that's kind of where we are in the world today. All of these other empires have come and gone, and the feet of iron and clay has been called the revived Roman Empire. And whether that's what it really is or not, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But people think that's it, because it's going to come out of the shadows of the old Roman Empire. And then, of course, that's going to be very unstable, a mixture of iron and clay, which tells you that it's going to be unstable. It's not going to be strong. The 10 toes are made out of pottery. And then a stone, unmade by human hands, uncut by human hands, flies into the picture, hits the statue at the base, crumbles all of the statue, and then the stone grows bigger and bigger. And that is the kingdom of God, which comes in the final stages, takes over the world for the Lord. That's a prediction of the millennial kingdom when the Lord comes back and reigns from Jerusalem. So we see in this statue a panorama of the time from 500 BC through the end of what we would call the end of time. And when we get down to the bottom part of it, it's a little less clear because it's not history. But we're going to talk about the bottom part of it today. And then we'll get a glimpse of the rock as it comes also today. So I want to go back to Daniel 11, verse 33 through 35. And that's where we ended last week. And that sort of sets us up for this week. And Daniel is being told by the angel who's talking to him, "Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered." This is speaking of people that are wise in the ways of the Lord. And we talked about before, even though Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the last ruler of the Seleucid Empire, had conquered Jerusalem, had sacrificed a pig on the altar, had done all the abominations, his end came. But there were a lot of people who fought him. And they fought him, and they were supported by others and not supported by others. And that's kind of what you see here. But for the people that stood up for the God of Israel, they were killed, they were burned, they were plundered. All of the things we know from history actually happened. And it says, when they fail, they'll receive a little help. So even though they failed to take over from Antiochus, they did receive some help from some of the people who were not so religious, but who had pity on them. And it says, and many who are not sincere will join them. We all know that, you know, sometimes we'll do things out of sympathy or pity, even though we don't really believe in the cause. I think, in my personal opinion, that's what a lot of things are happening today, especially in America. A lot of people are sympathetic with the Palestinians and with the mosque, but the fact is they don't understand history, and they don't understand the world situation, and they don't really understand the nature of the mosque. I mean, I see people that are, you know, alphabet, gay, transgender, whatever, speaking up for Hamas. I mean, they have to know that if they were in Gaza, they'd be killed. I mean, right away, no question about it. So, you know, it's a willful ignorance, I think. And I think that's some of what he speaks to here. He says, some of the wise will stumble, so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. And I think this speaks a little bit of the transition, because we're seeing today people who are for the Lord are being, some of them are having problems, and their churches are being taken away from them, or their denominations are splitting, and all of that. And yet God is refining some of those to bring them to a point where they're pure in heart, pure in motives. And I think that is not only played out there with the Jews, but it also is beginning to play out in our situation as well. But the end will still come at the appointed time. And I think that's a reminder that God has a calendar. We don't know what the dates are, but on the calendar at the appointed time, the end will come. Regardless of what we do, you know, we can pirouette in the parking lot all we want, but God's going to come when God's going to come, and that's the way it's going to work. And so he lays that out for us in verse 35. Then we come to verse 36, and we begin to make the departure into the future time. The king he's talking about here is after the other king has come to his end. This king, most interpreters believe, is who we call the Antichrist, or the lawless one, or the son of perdition, or whatever names, the man of sin, all the names the Bible calls this world ruler that will come. And this world ruler, by the way, will be the ruler of this mixed iron and clay kingdom, the revived Roman Empire. So let's not forget that. But I want to make a couple of points. The king will do as he pleases, which really means he'll have ultimate authority, and there won't be anybody to do checks and balances on him. Now, we know, and we can see from today's world, that if somebody would appear that could solve all the world's problems, they could solve peace in the Middle East, they could solve all the pandemics, they could solve all the wars, they could end hunger. There are so many people today that would sign up for that, regardless of what comes after that. They'd sign up for it because it gives them a peace they long for. And once they do, he will have authority to do whatever he wants to do. So this king will do as he pleases. I'm extrapolating this a little bit, but I think you can see it does make sense. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, but what has been determined must take place. So we begin to see something here called the time of wrath. And for us, biblically, this is the seventh week of Daniel, the final week, called the time of Jacob's trouble, or the tribulation period. It's the time where we're not living with man's wrath, but we're living with God's wrath. Different, much different than today. But I want to make another point. And I want to do it, and I want you to look at your translation of your Bible and look at the terms God and gods in here. And I've made a point of making the G red on both of them, because some of these are small letters and some of them are capital letters. And in the translations, they do it a little differently. Some do it a little differently. Now, I think all of them probably have a small G above every god and a capital G against the God of gods. They probably all have that. Any of yours different than that? Okay. I know the King James is a little different, but it's a little different in the next verse. So this king will magnify everything he does. It'll be the big deal. It will be covered on page one. It'll be broadcast on the nightly news. Whether we want to or not, we're going to hear everything about him every day. And he will elevate himself above every god small g, including the God of gods, and say unheard of things against the God of gods. I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's hard to imagine what he's going to say that others haven't said before, but he's going to say obviously blasphemous things against Jehovah God. It says he will be successful until the time of the wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. So his time will be over in the time of wrath. But let's look at the next verse. I've added verse 37, kind of remember how I did this at the bottom. He will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but exalt himself above them all. Now, in some of your translations, that word for God is capitalized, God of his ancestors. I know in the King James Version, I think that is capitalized, right? Okay. In most of the other versions, it's not, at least for my. So if you've got a version where it's capitalized other than King James, let me know what that is. But let me just say, it's important whether that word is capitalized or whether it isn't capitalized. You may not think about that, but the word here is the word Elohim. And the word Elohim means, it's a plural word, by the way, and it means God. And in the Bible, it is used two ways. It is used for the God of gods, and it is used as a general name for God. And how you view this depends on who you think the Antichrist is. If you say the God of his ancestors with a capital G, that would lead you to believe that the Antichrist is going to be a Jew. And people claim that. If it's not capitalized, you don't know whether he's going to be a Jew or not. But whatever the gods were of his ancestors or his forefathers, he shows no regard for them. And I'm not trying to make a statement about which is which. I think it's unclear which it is, whether it's God, the God, or whether it's God, the general God. But I guess all I'm saying is don't make a decision based on whether that's capitalized or not, because that is a interpreter's decision. The writers of the Bible, you know, not the writers, but the editors of the Bible, they decide where the phrases begin and end, where the chapters begin and end, what the numbering is. They decide all that and what's capitalized and what isn't. Now, there's convention that takes place there, but anyway, just be aware of that. So he will show no regard for the God of his ancestors. Now, that tells me that he's not interested in gods of any kind, whether they're his ancestors or any other gods. This is a curious verse, this next one. Or for the one desired by women. Some interpreters will say this means he's going to be gay. I don't think it means that. I don't think it says that, first of all, because I think one of the things we have to understand is this generation of women, Jewish women in particular, all wanted to be the mother of the Messiah. That was something that was desired by all of them. I think that's probably what's meant here, although it's not real clear, I have to say. Or for the one desired by women. In other words, for the God, this desired by women, this Messiah to come. I think what if you look at the big picture, what this tells you is this person has no regard for the God of gods, and he also has no regard for the Son of God. He has no regard for either of those gods. So he's not concerned at all with the God of the Bible, what we say the God of the Bible. Nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. I think this verse kind of clears up a little bit about who the Antichrist is. We don't know where he comes from. People think he comes from the revived Roman Empire, and that's possible. He could be a Jew. I don't think so. He could be a Muslim. I don't think so. But in any case, we don't really know what he is. But whatever he is, he believes himself to be better than all of them. He's making himself the God. In many ways, he's like the Caesars of the past, who declared themselves divine and declared worship for themselves. This guy is really no different. So context matters here. That's the only point I want to make on that verse. And then I think I add verse 38. Instead of them, in other words, instead of those gods, who is his God? He will honor a God of fortresses, a God unknown to his ancestors. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and many gifts. Who do you think a God of fortresses is? Military, power, strength. There's a lot of people that say, I know Israel is saying right now that Hamas understands one thing, and that's power. There's no nuance. You can't negotiate it with them because they don't have any interest in negotiation. But they do understand power, and they do understand advantage. And so Israel's trying to capture that. So this guy has no God, but his God is power. His God is armies. His God is weapons. His God is all of the power that he can accumulate. And he says, a God unknown to his ancestors. That's a little bit of a clue, I think, because it tells you that whoever his ancestors were didn't have a lot of power, didn't have a lot of military might. We still don't know who that is. But and maybe it's just a relative statement that he will have so much more than they did. But it says a God unknown to them, which to me means he kind of comes from a small country, a weak country. I know Vicky's got her bets. Who do you think it is? Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan. Little tiny country over next to Iran, one of the last parts of the Roman Empire. They're friendly with Israel, by the way, which is another point in point that ever we have. But I don't know who it is. It may be a small country. You know, he's a little horn, so he comes up from what appears to be a small country and takes over two other kingdoms. So perhaps it is. We'll have to wait and see, I guess. And it says he honors them with gold and silver and precious stones and costly gifts. So all of the people who support him are treated very liberally by him. You know, he doesn't hoard the money for himself. He passes it out among his peeps, so to speak. All the people that follow him, he makes them wealthy and makes them want to follow him. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of the foreign god. You can also read that strange God, and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and distribute the land at a price. This is unclear, except for the fact that it looks like, to me, at least to me, it looks like he will have another godlike entity on his side. And when you speak of the Antichrist, there's two things to understand about him. One is, he is the controller and the leader of the worldwide government. The second thing is, he has a henchman who we call the false prophet, who is the head of the worldwide religion. I think that's who he's talking about here. Again, Daniel, I mean, this is written 500 BC. He has no idea who these players are. But to him, it's a foreign god, a strange god. You know, a god, if he looks and sees the revived Roman Empire and the false church, it's strange to him. And so that's what he calls it, and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. So I think what you can see from this is this worldwide government and worldwide religion will be very wealthy, will be very powerful, and all the people who subscribe to it will be made wealthy and powerful. We also know from other verses that if you don't take the mark of the beast, you can't buy and sell goods. So on the other hand, while they're powerful, they can starve you out if you don't agree with them. Now, that's not part of Daniel, but that comes as you read Revelation, Zechariah, and a few other prophetic words. So I think we're beginning to see a few signs of who this person may be. He likes power. He likes wealth. He has no interest in God of any kind. He has no interest in Christ. He has no interest in God of gods. And he's going after and attacking the power. I mean, in many ways, Putin sort of fits that bill. You know, he is, although people think he's the predecessor for the Antichrist, I don't think he's going to get any worldwide acclaim, though. He's too brutal. But he may be a pattern of the type of thinking in this kind of guy. But we're seeing a few things to watch out for. And I think that's kind of interesting. And we come now to the, there's really five verses left in this chapter, so we may be finished early, which would be a break. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him. Now remember something here. All directions are north and south of Jerusalem. This king of the north and this king of the south is not the same as it was two chapters ago, because the time is different. This is not the time of Antiochus. This is the time of the Antichrist. So we're talking about the king of the south probably is Egypt, Libya, Sudan, all of the northern African countries that are kind of aligned with Libya and with Russia now. That's who I think that is. And the king of the north is not the little country of Syria, which has very little power, but it's probably Syria and Iraq and Turkey and some of the stands that are right north of there. Because what happens is this Antichrist does not come on board without some opposition. There are people that do not want him taking over their countries, and so they fight him. And, you know, king of the south, Egypt and all those, and king of the north, whoever that all that turns out to be, come against him with a great fleet of ships, chariots and cavalry, really means probably armament and soldiers. He'll invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. So it doesn't matter what they come at him with, the Antichrist will win that battle and take over those countries. And we sort of see that as you look through some other prophetic words. But then he says he will also invade the beautiful land. And again, the beautiful land is Israel. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. I don't think I have a map of this. Maybe I do. Yeah, I do. Okay, so Edom, Moab, Ammon is up here. Commonly today, they're all part of what we call Jordan. So whatever happens in this thing, Jordan will not fall prey to it. Let me go back and finish that verse. The leaders of Moab, the leaders of Ammon will be delivered. So we read that as the modern country of Jordan. I mean, it may go up a little higher than Jordan, but it's really the modern country of Jordan. And so this is all in the future. This is all ahead of us. So whatever this skirmish is that takes place, and whenever it takes place, it has not happened yet. And, you know, we also know from other scripture that the ring directly around Israel, which is Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia is not directly around, but they're tied to it, and Lebanon, do not come after Israel in this next great war. They sit on the sidelines. So we're beginning to see, and prophecy, they call that the inner ring of countries around Israel. And the outer ring is the countries that bring war. And while I can't say this is definitely talking about that, it does seem to be very prophetic, and that it speaks to something that could very well be that. Again, I don't have history to go back on here, so I'm just speculating what it might be. But I think it's kind of interesting that this at this time, this Antichrist will also begin to take over Israel. Now, we know further from this the time of Jacob's trouble or the seven-year period that Israel is at peace for the first few years of the tribulation period and is allowed to rebuild its temple. Because if he didn't rebuild its temple, he couldn't desecrate it in the middle of the tribulation period. So we know that Israel is comes in line with this Antichrist, and they support whatever he's doing because it's good for them and allows them to live in peace at least for a bit. So I think all of this fits. I don't know whether I'm being accurate here. I will just say, you know, if you look at this map and you look at these are old countries, in the old times, you know, you've got Cana, Phoenicia, all this, Philistia. Down here is Gaza. You can see Gaza right here in the modern map. And then that's the West Bank. This is the Golan Heights, all of which are part of Israel today, even though they're disputed. This is a disputed part. Israel runs this part up here, and then Israel gave up Gaza, but we'll see what happens with that from now on. So you can see Saudi Arabia barely touches Israel, if you want to look at it down here at the port of Eilat, I believe that is. I can read it here. I can't see it. Maybe Eilat. I can't tell what it is. Haifa, maybe. One of them is up here, and one of them is down here, and I never remember which one it is. But Jordan has got a long common border with them, and Syria has a very touch point border here, although you would say this is a Syrian border, and of course Lebanon up here. So all of that is in play here. I don't know where it's going to go, but at least that's what's in play.
You have a sense of bring around Israel, while they may not join the forces against them, they basically provide an avenue.
They do, and they don't resist. They stand back and they let whatever happens, happens. And I put this map up here, not to say this is Gog and Magog, but just because it's pretty interesting map to show you where the forces come from. This is Egypt right here. It's called Mizraim in the Old Testament. And then Libya and Put. Libya was really way over here, way over into Tunisia, I believe, and Morocco. And then Kush is really the land of Sudan now, not Ethiopia. It was called Ethiopia, but it's a different land because it's in a different place. And then, of course, Persia. And then all these countries, this is what I really was thinking of as the king of the north. This is the king of the south in this argument here. These are probably the two kings that resist him. And, of course, Israel is right in the middle. He will conquer both of these countries and have control of all of this area. Which is kind of interesting. Again, that's future, and it's somewhat speculative, but it also fits very well. Now, verse 44 and 45 in this chapter, but I want to spend a few minutes on them. It says, so now, and the Antichrist has taken back over. He's taken over some of these lands, and he's taken over the area of Egypt. He's taken over the northern kingdom. But reports from the east and the north alarm him. Now, the north here, I think, is probably the further north. This is probably reports of Russia and some of the upper Magog countries, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and all those, the stands. And from the east, I think this sort of gives vision to the kings of the east who come. In the prophetic world, this is called the 200 million man army that comes from, people say, China. But it could be China, probably will be, but it could be India. India is going to take over the biggest country in the world in the next few years. Could be North Korea. Could be a combination of all of them. We don't know who it is. But it's 200 million people, an army of 200 million, that come from the east and come over here to take on the Antichrist. So what does he do? He will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He'll pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain. This whole area here, this whole area, this says Jezreel Valley, but the Jezreel Valley really comes all the way down to here. And the way this reads, he pitches his tents. Because the Holy Mountain is Mount Moriah, it's the Temple Mount. So people think that the seas he's talking about is the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. So he pitches his army's tents in this area right in here, probably all in this area. to guard and begin to defend. This is all mountainous here, so he's got some allies with geography. So he's placing himself here. We find that this is an interesting place, this valley of Jezreel, the Jezreel Valley, because this is where the historical Gog and Magog Armageddon war takes place. I'm going to show you something in a minute. But he'll pitch his tent there, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. Again, I think this probably is speaking of this end time war. And I couldn't find the book this morning, but I'll bring it in next week and let you see it. I've got a little book written by Dave Reagan called The Nine Wars of the End Times. And it goes through in great detail and lays out what he sees as the wars of the end times. And some of them are physical wars, and a couple of them are spiritual wars, wars fought in heaven between angels. And we saw a little bit of that a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about, you know, the angels in Daniel, you know, fighting against the demonic angels of Persia and Greece. We saw a little bit of that with Michael and Gabriel and whatever. And so he, you know, some of those wars he calls out and they're part of his nine. But it's kind of interesting because he really picks the verses out and he discriminates between why this is not the same war as that war. It's interesting. We kind of read it and we look at it and we say, I don't know whether they're different, but it seems like war is always going on. From that time forward. And of course, the Bible tells us it'll be a time of war until the end. And we're seeing it. You can't look at the world and you can't look at Israel. You can't look at the surrounding territory without seeing war all the time. I mean, there are wars going on in Africa that nobody's even talking about. You know, there's massive starvation. There's massive genocide going on in Africa right now. And it's not on the world stage. Nobody cares. Nobody's put it out there. Why? They're all focused on Israel, tiny little Israel. As I've said before, Israel is the key to the timepiece of the end times. Watch Israel. Watch the city of Jerusalem and watch the Temple Mount. You'll kind of see God's time clock for the end times. So no one comes to will help him. And that's really because God comes to fight this battle, and that battle is fought on the holy mountains of Israel, and God wins that battle. You can read all about that in Revelation, Zechariah, and a couple of others. I want to do something now, which will take about 4 or 5 minutes. We were there in 2011, and Megiddo is a town. It's a little bit south of, it's in the lower Galilee. So it's if you're in Capernaum and you go towards the Mediterranean, like the Philippi, and you come south, you get to Megiddo. When you're in Megiddo, you're in a town that has been, it's being excavated. And it's got, I don't know, 15 or 20 empires of data there. 23, I knew it was something like that. 23. And as they dig down, they found these people were here then these people were here. And it's really ruins now, but it's on a hill that overlooks the Jezreel Valley. And of course, so Armageddon, the term Armageddon, it comes from the term Har Megiddo. Har means hill, hill of Megiddo. So that's where Armageddon comes from. If you ever wondered, it's not a name in the Bible except for a name of this place. So I'm going to show you some pictures here, and then I'm going to talk for a second. This is hope this plays. Oh yeah, so it's going to play silently. This are some of the ruins in Megiddo, the stables of Solomon. This is where you can walk through and see. It's still pretty well area. It's a big area where Solomon had all of his stables. And this is looking out on the Jezreel Valley. Okay, so I'm going to stop right here for a second, if I can figure out how to do that real quick. As you look out on the Jezreel Valley from this hill, there's a couple things that are real visible. It is the breadbasket of Israel. This is where fruit trees and everything are grown here. It's very, very fertile land. There's mountains off to the left. Some of the mountains in the book of Judges are over there. Back to your far left is Nazareth. It's to the north. But you can see where it is if you're up on top of Megiddo. And there's something that's hidden that I can't find in these pictures. But down in the valley here, there is what looks like a landing strip. And it's about, I don't know, half a mile long. And what you discover is that Israel houses their F-16s and F-35s underneath this strip. So when you least expect it, a door opens, a plane comes up, the door shuts, and it taxis out and takes off. We were there, and we kept hearing F-16s overhead. They were patrolling. I mean, again, this is 12 years ago. But it's fascinating. Israel has hidden their planes, but Israel covers. There are planes in the air all the time over Israel. It's very narrow up in this area. So let me okay, I didn't mean to do that. Let me keep going here. If I can make this work. Now, this is me on a windy day. It's going to be windy, so bear with me. No, I didn't want to do all this again. All right. I didn't try stopping this at home, so bear with me. This will come to pass pretty quick. If you've never been there, though, you really need to take time to go to Megiddo, or Megiddo, as they call it. Yeah, it's an interesting place. Probably. So you can see the fertile farmland here, tractors, and somewhere over here on the left side is where the airplane is. Okay, so I'm going to talk now. We're standing on the top of it here. It's very windy, so you'll probably hear some. I don't have a wind filter. Those are the mountains of Deborah over on the far side, where Deborah was and the judges. Mount Tabor, I think. Vicky's in here somewhere, I think. I don't know where. That was her back here on the left. I think. Yep, right there. Putting her hat up. So Mount Carmel is on the side of the Mediterranean. It's up where that little peak goes up in Israel. Okay, so that's that. I tried to find better stills, but I couldn't find them. I looked through my. Oh yeah. Well, Napoleon said this is an ideal place for a battle, you know, because it's wide, it's circled by mountains, and it's also about 40 miles, 50 miles long. And from up there, it goes all the way down, you know, to the side of Israel over by the Mediterranean. It comes in around Jerusalem. So I'm going to stop here. I'm not going to get into chapter 12 because it's also fairly short, but I'll do that next week. So I would just say, read the rest of Daniel and we'll cover that. I want to leave you with what is important next week. So when you think about Daniel, what are the key things? I may give you a handout to remember some things by. Mm-hmm. But pray for the hostages, those that are there. And again, I use the term hostages. They're not soldiers. They're not combatants. They were innocent people, you know, who were just there. Their crime is being Jewish. Pray for Israel and its leaders. Pray for our country and its leaders. And we're all in a pretty bad fix. And, you know, we need to pray for not only our church, but all the churches that are upholding the Word of God. And for faithful pastors and congregations to stay in that line. I would say pray a hedge of protection for all those who preach the word. Because I think in this day and time, you know, you're seeing a lot of antagonism. If you're a Christian, you know, you're going to draw the ire just like you were a Jew. And so it's kind of a delicate time. We're fortunate where we are. We're also prepared. So I would say, you know, in our church, we're not babes in the woods here. We're prepared if something happens. And our pastor is prepared in season and out of season. So I'm just praying for him and the staff. And of course, pray for each other. I think it's important. We've got a lot of healing going on, broken bones taking place and healing, you know, sickness, surgeries perhaps pending. So just pray for that. And I would say, watch for the signs of the times. The pastor, I think, had a great chart last week where he talked about how blank the landscape of signs were, and how in the last few years the signs have been coming rapid fire. And that all speaks to the convergence and the increasing times, you know, the communications, the all the other things that are happening today. Israel being back in the land. I don't know where it's going to go today, but I'm sure it'll be one of the signs that, you know, is all around us. We just have to pay attention to it. Any question? I know people are talking about the sermons. I've heard a lot of people say, when they say something, talk to them, engage them, you know, try to make it important. Yeah, Carl.
We were told the 50,000 people a week are watching.
Yeah, and that's incredible. That's incredible. I mean, the reach of that, and of course, it's recorded, so you don't know how many people are going to watch it in the future. You know, so it's important. Good point. Thank you. Well, let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll get out 5 minutes early. How's that? Lord, thank you for this time. Thank you for Daniel, who didn't understand a thing about what he was writing. But Lord, thank you for the angel explaining it to him and him writing it down in such a way that we can see the fulfillment of your prophecy. Those that have come to pass, literally fulfilled, and those that are still in the future, which we believe will be literally fulfilled. Lord, help us today. Help us be closer to you. Help us pray and seek your will for our lives. Help us be about the business you've called us to be about. Help us be ready when the time comes. Lord, I do pray for the pastor. I do pray for his anointing. I pray for the power in his speech, in his sermon, to reach our very hearts and open our eyes when we need to be open. Lord, I pray all of this in the blessed and holy name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you all. It's an assisted living home up in Dawsonville. I am
doing
some lessons there, first and third Wednesdays of every month.
Good job.
Thank you.
Is Hamas actually demanding certain objects, bring people by name?
No. They'd like to get all their high-end prisoners, but Israel's not doing that. Israel has released.
But did they request it? Because I remember one time hearing that they were requesting a certain person. And I was like, are they seriously getting away with that?
No, they're not. Israel's not doing that. Okay. Israel rejected that demand. They're giving them terrorists, but they're low-level terrorists. They're knifing. People are doing knifing or trying to do bombs. They're not. Some of them are killers.
I thought they were like leaders. That prisoner that they were demanding.
Yeah, no, they can demand what they want, but it's not what they're going to get. You know, so more than.
I was just wondering about the Abraham Accords.
Abraham Accords, yes.
That wouldn't be considered release.
It would be.
Well, everybody says that until this peace happens, peace treaty happens, then
it's. I think the peace treaty they're talking about may be the Abraham Accords, but see, the big fish, Saudi Arabia, is not in that yet. So it's really all these little tiny countries, but it is a start. And if that peace treaty gets bigger and the Antichrist confirms it, that will give Israel peace.
Are you shut down?
I am, yeah.